Well, I'm going to talk, I guess, in essence, about why the Christian right is, from a Christian standpoint, as much of a pain in the neck sometimes as the religious left. This past Sunday, my church bulletin ran this edifying announcement, quote, "Is cutting health, income assistance, nutrition, and safety guarantees of millions of children and shredding the national safety net for children the kind of reform we support?" Call President... Call President Clinton to let him know what you were for. I was hungry, thirsty, homeless, sick, and you, so forth. So into this ominous message, a despicable piece of propaganda pretending that Jesus and the welfare state are on the same side. Funny, I don't seem to recall him telling the Roman authorities to extend the grain dole to Judea or Zacchaeus to go and collect more taxes to make it possible. While all Americans have suffered the tyranny of the religious left since the turn of the century, and I guess therefore I shouldn't have been surprised to see the Catholic bishops hold a full-blown press conference this past Tuesday to denounce any cuts in welfare. Came complete with press kits, studies, statements by the clergy. Press packed the room and took down every word, and the New York Times featured a prominent article on how God opposes a balanced budget. Needless to say, the bishops love this stuff. It makes them the media darlings they appreciate, that they aspire to be. Gives them an excuse not to do what they're supposed to be doing, which is tend to their diocese. While they're pronouncing on public policy, virtually every parish in the country is seeking deeper into the mire of modernism. With a hierarchy that is no real help or even a stumbling block, parishes are racked with sloppy liturgies, feminist control, ear-splitting music, and all the rest. Is this contrast between the current state of the Christian faith, which is deeply troubling, and the far-flung political activities of the leadership that I would like to address? For the civil religion is systematically swamping the real religion. In the American context, it was Lincoln who pioneered the use of religious imagery for the aggrandizement of state power, and many Christians bought into it. Think of how many people still sing the battle hymn of that horrible bloody hymn, the battle hymn of the Republic. Today, the left still thrives on the religious gloss that Christians are sometimes willing to apply to aspects of Leviathan. Christians are willing to lend the accumulated capital of their doctrines to what is a destructive and secular project. Despite their claims to oppose the mixing of church and state, the religious left's political message, from abolitionism to integrationism to welfareism, has thrived on it. And it is this kind of outrage, combined with a fierce attack on the Christian religion by the modern secular state, that's given rise to a reaction from what is called the religious right. Now, in some institutions, that movement understands the priority that the city of God takes over the city of man for Christians, as Christians. In other institutions, and I'm thinking now of the Christian Coalition, the established pro-life organizations, and the U.S. Bishops' Conference, this movement is beginning to lead to a redefinition of the Christian faith. For many in the leadership, the faith has become a mere means to an essentially secular project, which involves heavy doses of political and doctrinal compromise. Forgotten in the fog of activism that characterizes today's Christianity is the purpose of the faith, which of course is the worship of God and the salvation of souls. Before the Christian churches of America decide to replace the Apostles' Creed with the contract with the American family, let's examine the dangers associated with a left-wing social religion. One is corruption, and we see that destruction all around us. But a far more dangerous consequence of left-wing political activism has tended to be overlooked, and it is the core temptation that the religious right faces today. The use of religion in social activism damages the faith. Once the social gospel became a key tenet of mainline Christianity, the entire body of doctrine began to fall apart. The consequences were destructive for both Protestantism and Catholicism. Christians came to believe that their first job as Christians was to pronounce on matters of public policy. They looked towards affairs of state and incorporated specific political doctrines into their body of belief. Let's look at one area, the entanglement of Christians in the civil rights movement. Primary concern of the founders and of the funders of the civil rights movement was not faith or justice, but envy and egalitarianism. Yet those behind that movement knew that their best hope was to put a religious and ethical gloss on a power involving a policy involving raw state power, and hoped that Christians couldn't tell the difference. And it worked extremely well. Stanley Levison is a fine example of this. As David Garrow reports, he was Martin Luther King's most trusted friend and advisor. He wrote King's books and speeches, managed his finances, even paid his bills. Yet he was also a communist, a probable agent of the KGB, and a rich benefactor to communist causes. He was also extremely smart. Religious imagery was the mainstay of Levison's vocabulary. He was a master of quoting scripture to make political points. It's chilling how a person whose goals were completely secularist and statist could make the man he controlled sound so pious. And the non-communist followers of King, at least some of them, didn't know what was behind this apparent man of God. The social gospel movement culminating in the civil rights movement was so successful in a religious sense that it caused the Christian religion to incorporate Levisonianism as a key component of its moral teaching. The Catholic bishops, who have almost junked the sacrament of penance, now tell Catholics to confess to the sin of racism, whatever that may be. Obviously, as was pointed out by Professor Levin earlier, if something is already a sin, treating somebody, lying for racial purposes or whatever, the problem is the lying, not the non-sinful aspects of what is described as racism. The evangelical group Promise Keepers lists love of all races among its six rules for living. When the political leaders of what is broadly called the Christian right speak about the religious left, they mention the bad effects of the policies they impose, and they'll talk on TV and radio for hours about the destructive effects of welfare, abortion, no-fault divorce, and so forth. But what they cannot imagine is that their movement is not immune from the same kind of duplicity that was at the heart of the civil rights movement. They don't understand the corruptions that are associated with the city of man, and the dangers of neglecting the core concerns of the faith. The entry of Christians as Christians into the public square may, for the most part, have been good for the country, but I'm not convinced it's been good for Christianity. Pick up a copy of the New American Enterprise magazine. It features short profiles and interviews with some 60 different conservative religious leaders. There are some good people profiled there, and perhaps the trouble with the interviews can be blamed on the editors or the forum. But every person interviewed had provocative statements to make about public policy or the charitable missions they were undertaking to make up for the failures of the welfare state. What was strangely underplayed or entirely missing was any mention of faith. No talk of salvation, grace, sacraments, need for individual penance, or sin. Moreover, there's no discussion about the disastrous state of the church today, theologically, liturgically, and musically. Apparently, things like the salvation of individual souls are concerns for old-timey Christians. Today, Christians to be in vogue with the media elite are supposed to be more public-spirited than that. They have to take positions as Christians on the welfare state, vouchers, abortion rights, and so forth. What led to Christian conservatives getting stuck in this trap? Well, many of them have Lincoln envy and King envy. Those two figures used religion to advance a social cause, and very effectively. Why shouldn't they do the same? When people like Ralph Reed and other professional activists compare themselves to abolitionists or civil rights protesters, they think they're confounding their critics. In fact, they're only introducing the core assumption of the social gospel into the faith and thereby corrupting it. That assumption is that for Christians, the affairs of the city of man should be of equal or greater concern than those of the city of God. Few people seem to recognize the extent to which politics has had a corrosive effect on the Christian faith, especially in blinding people to the needs within their own souls or churches. A political activism, I obviously believe, is necessary, but it can never replace the intellectual and spiritual activism that sustains a robust faith, a virtuous clergy, a beautiful liturgy, great music, or any of the other markings of the Christian faith of old. I don't care how many 10-point plans for America that the Christian Coalition passes at their board meetings, they can never substitute for an orthodox view of the Trinity. Yet Christianity is now thoroughly politicized from both right and left. The bishops and Ralph Reed have no trouble speaking before millions about the importance of alleged pro-family legislation or the glories of religious pluralism, but they're shy about giving an account of the Christian teaching on salvation. The longer the process of politicization continues, the thinner the faith gets. Political ambition causes people to water down key tenets for the sake of gaining favor with the powers that be. This danger is especially prevalent in a society with a number of competing religions. The first stage of the sellout comes with the exaltation of political pluralism above doctrinal truth. The second stage is to deny doctrinal truth altogether for the sake of achieving certain political goals. Richard Neuhaus provided us with a classic example last year. His magazine First Things printed a social manifesto that was signed by prominent Protestants and Catholics. In page after page, it chronicled our troubles with family breakup, crime, declining respect for authority, growing permissiveness towards sexual deviancy, the trouble with schools, etc. And there was truth in much of it. But then there was a surprise ending, and some of the signers claimed to have missed it. The signers pledged themselves to forget proselytizing, or what they called, quote, sheep stealing. They agreed to put their differences aside permanently for the sake of saving society from the consequences of liberalism. Now, if I know this publication's infatuation with the wrong kind of ecumenicism, this was the whole point of the manifesto. But this is a path to ruin. There are real differences between Catholics and Protestants, and they are larger than mere subjective preference. No social crisis, no matter how large, should be allowed to drive either side to promise not to bring up issues like the nature of the Eucharist. If we do, we put aside core beliefs for the sake of the larger goal of improving the social order. And then where do we draw the line? Do we sign a pact with the Muslims not to discuss Christ? The politicization of Christianity has had an especially pernicious effect on the Catholic faith. In our times, the problems began with Vatican II, and its documents had much to say about politics and faith and precipitated a revolution in the church that brought on 3 decades of liturgical and theological chaos. Mass attendance, for example, is at less than 40% of what it was before the council. How did they get away with it? Why did conservatives not revolt? Well, few of them did, but many more didn't on grounds that they wanted to support Humanae Vitae, Paul VI's letter on abortion and birth control. Conservatives hung on to this document and the theology behind it with dear life to the exclusion of all other concerns. In those days, conservative Catholics noticed something that the mass of Christians only picked up on several years after Roe v. Wade. Once you know a person's position on abortion, you couldn't usually tell his position on a whole range of other issues. Abortion rights people were probably also welfare status, lovers of the UN, supporters of alternative lifestyles, and the whole works. Catholics figured that so long as the Pope was sound on abortion, he was probably okay in most other matters of politics, an assumption which does not follow these days. Catholic right became defenders of the single issue of abortion and developed an enormous industry to do it. But there was and remains the danger that being pro-life would become a concern exclusive of all other issues, and especially the issues that concern the faith more directly. During the welfare debate, Republicans faced some fierce opposition to talk of cutting off subsidies to poor women who choose to have children out of wedlock. Initially, the opposition was from the left. But the political force that eventually defeated the idea was the National Right to Life Committee. Their reasoning was that young women might choose to abort their children if they find out someone won't pay them to have them. The Family Research Council, not to speak of Alan Carlson and other people at the Rockford Institute, desperately tried to explain that cutting off subsidies was an essential precursor to changing the culture of promiscuity that governs the inner city. But National Right to Life merely expressed shock that any pro-lifer would disagree on welfare for single mothers. Being pro-life was the first political priority, they said, because it flowed out of the deepest religious principles. Therefore, any policy that might lead to more abortions had to be evil and therefore opposed. With that, it became clear that the establishment within the pro-life movement had joined the forces of socialism. One wonders how far they will take this idea. What if someone proposes to have the federal government pay, say, $100,000 for every birth in this country as an anti-abortion method? Would the pro-lifers support that too? My guess is they would. 30 years ago, however, no way, they would have understood that there were other principles at stake. But today they're afflicted with such myopia they can't see beyond a single concern. Democratic Party may listen up. If they were to become pro-life, they could draw a tremendous amount of support away from the Republicans, even if they changed nothing else in their program. This strategy has worked for liberal Catholic bishops all over the country. Perfecting a tactic first used by Ronald Reagan, they know that merely giving a yearly homily on the evil of abortion means that their host of heresies and liturgical blasphemies will be overlooked. It was just earlier this month, the Catholic bishops issued a statement on political responsibility warning people not to be too anti-government, I think was the purpose of it. But because they make the abortion point conservative Catholics either overlook it or don't criticize it if they don't overlook it. And for example, they start out with the first principle is that they're going to continue to defend human life as the preeminent human rights issue of our day and strongly opposing abortion and euthanasia. Then they move on to opposing anti-personnel landmines, the death penalty, to support for affirmative action, to support for more government jobs programs, support for radical environmentalism, more food stamps, socialized medicine that, of course, respects life, public housing, anti-discrimination law, to oppose anti-immigrant sentiments, we're all in trouble in this room, to reject isolationism, and for gun control. They support anti-violence policies that oppose abortion and the easy availability of deadly weapons. The problem of politicization goes to the highest levels in the church. The Pope seems to believe that by traveling from place to place, he's fulfilling his role. Meanwhile, this year orders came down from Rome allowing altar girls, a decision that has ruined the credibility of conservative priests who had opposed the innovation for years. By staying in Rome, guarding the faith, vetoing altar girls, cracking down on liturgical and other abuses, permitting a wider celebration of older forms of worship, policing the seminaries, supervising the bishops, in other words, by being the Pope, he could have done a lot more for the faith than by all his world travels. Now, some people say, well, he brought down communism. I don't think that's actually true, but by Catholic doctrine, his neglect of parish life and the integrity of the sacraments, if that's led one soul astray, then all the rest of this is not worth it. Let me give you another example from the papacy of John Paul II. Here are his words to the United Nations this year. Quote, how can we fail to acknowledge the role of the United Nations organization? It needs to rise above the cold status of an administrative institution and to become a moral center where all the nations of the world feel at home and develop a shared awareness of being. The United Nations, he said, has the historic, even momentous task of raising the level of relations between nations to a more organic level, from a simple existence with others to an existence for others. In a fruitful exchange of gifts, primarily for the good of the weaker nations, but even so a clear harbinger of greater good for everyone, unquote. Now, when secular liberals talk this way, we rightly call them muddle-headed socialists. But when a religious leader says these things, we have to be concerned. Didn't Christians once believe that the moral center of nations and the shared awareness among all peoples was the church? Are we really supposed to believe that it's now the United Nations or that Christianity equals foreign aid? Now, I have no consuming desire for a pope who hates the United Nations, opposes the minimum wage, favors low taxes, endorses secession. Free market pope would be better than a socialist and a globalist pope, but if he's more interested in the city of man than the city of God, same problems remain. In her speech before the United Nations, Mother Teresa took a different route. She related how often people come up to her and ask her, how can we do what you do? And she tells them, don't do what I do. Do what you were supposed to do. Be a good father to your children. Be a good worker. Be a good mother to your children. Be responsible for those in your care. This is advice the church needs as well. Christians do not need to leave political activism, although some leaders of the prominent groups seem to me to represent as great a danger as their secular opponents, but for Christians to proclaim themselves as religious people who are tired of sitting at the back of the bus and follow Rosa Parks in demanding their rights as a special interest group is to ensure that Christianity becomes a cultural and political force first while its true spiritual power begins to wane. The result is an American religious leadership more interested in public pronouncements and press conferences and becoming part of the establishment than in saving souls and defending the faith from attack. Many of these people would rather be written up in Peter Steinfeld's New York Times religion column than in what the Baptists call the Lamb's Book of Life. But the neoconservatives are, of course, not unhappy about this. The Straussian school of political philosophy, to which most of them belong, views religion as false but politically useful. That means Straussians are willing to use the sentiments of Christianity as the moral backing for causes that have nothing to do with the gospel. We will be more vulnerable to this if we allow our churches to become little more than political action committees. Religious conservatives need to recognize that the core of their faith cannot be found in the public square. That square is not the source of good families, good theology, real churches with authentic liturgies, loving neighbors, let alone salvation. What is the Christian to do in the public square? Certainly not pretend to establish a Christian-friendly official culture in Washington or get the government to start subsidizing religious schools as versus public ones. Christians cannot hope to impress the governing elites with the fruits of their religion, except to the extent that they fulfill the designs of that elite. Neither can they hope to gain greater tolerance for the expression of Christian values from a regime that is hostile at its core. Christians should avoid the temptation to become part of the Leviathan state, should refuse to follow those who would use the faith for the purpose of currying favor with evil, and should remember the accumulated evidence that faith's greatest earthly enemy is the secular, centralized, democratic, egalitarian state. At all costs, Christians must not allow themselves to be reduced to another pleading interest group in this awful apparatus. Thank you.